You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to this Times Higher Education issue review podcast for the edition covering the 26th of October to the 1st of November 2017. My name is Chris Parr. I'm joined by books editor Matthew Rice and reporters Ellie Bothwell and Jack Grove. So-called predatory conferences, academic events that purport to be legitimate scholarly gatherings, but which are in fact shoddy, poorly attended scams designed to con academics out of presentation and attendance fees, now outnumber legitimate academic conferences, a researcher warns this week. It's little wonder when you read Jack's lead news story this week. One conference organiser he hears about claims to be holding almost 60,000 individual conferences next year alone. Why are scholars attending and presenting at these seemingly dodgy events? Find out in just a moment. Matthew has been speaking to Devorah Baum, lecturer in English Literature and Critical Theory at the University of Southampton, about her new books, one looking at Jewish jokes, one of which I will tell for you in a little while, and one entitled Feeling Jewish, a book for just about everyone. He will give us an overview of their conversations a little later. And Ellie has been chatting to Nobel laureate Jean Triol about the direction that his research has taken since winning the Nobel Prize for Economic Sciences in 2014. But first to you, Jack. Predatory conferences, some quite remarkable statistics in your lead news story this week. Give us a bit of background to what they are and why they exist.
Yes, well, everyone's heard of bogus journals and predatory publishers in academia, but I think this is a less well-known problem, and it's a sort of spin-off problem. It's rather questionable organisations holding these conferences, which appear to look sort of totally fine and totally legitimate, but actually when you pay your money and turn up, it's actually a very sort of sobering experience. I spoke to one UK researcher who decided to apply to speak at this conference in Copenhagen. He had a very interesting paper on Brexit and political psychology. He wanted to get his message out there. So he went along to Copenhagen, paid almost £1,000 in flights, accommodation and conference fees. When he got there, there was about 10 people in the room. The conference was compressed into 2 hours in the first morning. In the second day, it was only 1 hour. Mm. No one else from his... Well, there was one other person from his discipline was there. Everyone else was speaking about totally unrelated topics, such as Iranian crop rotation, food safety, robots. It was totally bizarre.
So a really focused afternoon of study.
You know, I'm all for interdisciplinary events, but this just didn't seem to... You know, it was a totally worthless event. And when he looked into this, he found actually this organisation is purporting to hold 60,000 conferences next year, about 300. But actually, in effect, there's 300 sort of subject strands all condensed into one conference, and that means and they're very poorly attended, as you might expect. So only 10 to 50 people have a show, but still. There's lots of organisations out there organising these, and tens of thousands of academics, I'm told, are now attending these what we call sort of scam conferences.
And you write an accompanying comment alongside, in which you say sort of, you know, receiving invitations to speak at events that maybe aren't prestigious or in some cases are, you know, downright scandalous is part of a day-to-day routine of an academic. Yeah. So. Is there any insight into why some are getting through, if you like? I mean, if you get 10 people attending a conference and they're all paying, you know, £500 to do so, then people are going to do it, aren't they? Keep doing it.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's two types of people. There's people who just think, I don't care if it's a bogus event, I'm just going to go to a nice city, have a nice break, maybe take my family along.
Right.
And then I might even just put it on my CV, because who's really going to look at this? But there's other people who, like my interviewee, he genuinely wanted to speak at this event, and he Googled it and it happened to pop up, and the site looked legit and he signed up. And it's basically, these things are popping up on search engines, and unless you do a bit of background research, you could get quite easily fall into the trap and look a bit foolish, as he certainly feels. But he wants to get the message out and say, you know, this is quite a big problem now, and universities perhaps aren't really talking about it because it might seem like such an obvious scam, but it's not.
Yeah, sure. Well, you can read that news story in the magazine this week, also on TimesHigherEducation.com, of course, and indeed Jack's accompanying blog is available online and in the magazine too. Now, change of scenery. Picture the scene. A woman's had a few friends over. The afternoon is drawing to a close. The guests are getting ready to leave. Mrs. Goldberg, says one of the ladies, I just wanted to tell you that your cookies were so delicious I ate four of them. You ate five, replies Mrs. Goldberg, but who's counting? I'm sure I'm not doing that joke any justice whatsoever, but Matthew, it features in a book on Jewish jokes that you've been speaking to its author about this week, Devorah Baum, a lecturer at the University of Southampton.
Yes, well, she put together a synopsis for a book which is about Jewish feelings and sensibility, and it's a very serious book drawing on psychoanalysis and critical theory and so on, and she's saying how, because Jewish history, there's been a lot of persecution, there's a kind of paranoia, a lot of Jews feel a kind of, as it were, justified paranoia. And but she's arguing that perhaps we're all Jewish now, in the sense with lots of surveillance cameras everywhere, we're all feeling a bit paranoid. So it's about certain habits of sensibility and feeling which have been associated with Jews, but now more widespread. So it's a pretty serious argument. But when she put in the synopsis to a publisher, she included a few jokes, because, you know, sensibility is often expressed quite best very well in jokes. And the publisher was, Profile Books was a general publisher, and the editor there said, well, this is a really serious book, you should definitely publish by an academic publisher, but we would like to, why don't you just do a joke book, take all the jokes out and turn those in a separate book for us, for a more popular audience. So that's what she's done. And if you read the two books together, they're in a way making rather similar arguments. But one is by using jokes and one is by, you know, analysing novels and psychoanalysis and stories of the Holocaust. So it's a rather curious project. But it is, the joke book is absolutely brilliant. Even though I'd heard most of the jokes, quite a few of the jokes before, I was still roaring with laughter throughout. And her analysis is very perceptive and interesting as well.
I'm happy to say a few of those books are in the feature. Sorry, a few of those jokes are in the feature. Both books are mentioned, of course they are. But I mean, it turned out I actually knew Devorah Baum from I think she did a Newsnight interview a few months ago about a film that she'd made with her husband about them trying to conceive, trying to have
a child. Yes, this was a film they made about trying to have a child and using fertility treatment and so on. And then she got pregnant, and it was all very exciting. They were all very happy, and they were doing interviews, and he was very excited, but was sort of saying, "Oh well, is she going to love the baby more than me? And will she want to have sex anymore?" These kind of typical middle class male problems. But what then happened? It all went tragically wrong, and in fact, she was pregnant with twins, and one of them died in utero. Remarkably, they decided to continue filming each other, partly as a kind of project to keep going. And sometimes they had arguments and forgot to turn the camera on, so they had to reconstruct the arguments. I mean, it's a very extraordinary project. It's very interesting and fascinating, but very painful to watch. But she claims, and I think it's quite an interesting claim, that actually the film is counts as research in some ways. It is saying very interesting things about late pregnancy, what the impact of fertility treatments, what, you know, what heterosexual marriage is like now and the way it's changed.
She's considering submitting it to the Research Excellence Framework.
She might well, yes.
Interesting. Well, all of those aspects of Devorah Baum's research are covered in that interview. You'll find it in the magazine on page 38. And again, of course, you'll find it under the features tab on TimesHigherEducation.com. Ellie, moving on, back to the news section this week, you've been chatting to Nobel laureate Jean Triaul about his research and the sort of way he's felt a need to connect more with people after he won the Nobel Prize for Economics several years ago.
Yes, yes, he won the Nobel Prize in 2014, and he spoke to me about how he'd always sort of, you know, worked with policymakers throughout his career, but actually it was only when he won the prize and kind of general members of the public stopped him in the street and said, you know, I don't understand your research, I can't read a thing, that he actually realised he maybe had a duty to explain more to the, you know, to Joe Bloggs what his research was about. And he also spoke about sort of, you know, the kind of general kind of rise of populism in the US and Europe, and how that means that academics now have, you know, an even greater need to show that their research is relevant to the public. And he suggested a kind of, you know, one way that academics can kind of reverse this populist trend is to kind of band together and prove that they have a consensus over, you know, certain ideas. So he said, you know, it's normal, obviously, in research to have, you know, differing opinions and for academics to argue and debate about the right, you know, course of action or the right kind of ideas. But actually, the best way to speak to the public is for, you know, academics to come up with a kind of broad range of shared opinions, that, and, you know, that's the best way to prove their value. Otherwise, the public can say, well, all the experts disagree, so there's no point me listening to experts.
It's interesting he's gone that way in a way, isn't it? Because if you win a Nobel Prize, I guess you get a sort of blank check if you like to do what you want. You're never going to be out of work. You could probably start looking into some real minutiae topics that might not have that broader interest and do it safe and sound in the knowledge that, well, you've got a Nobel Prize, you're probably going to get a decent job at a decent institution. So it's interesting that he's sort of gone the other way.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as I kind of mentioned that in the article, that, you know, you think most Nobel Prize winners would think, oh great, I can now, you know, start working on really exciting problems. I don't have to worry about research funding anymore. I can work in whatever position in academia I want. And actually, yeah, he's the direction he's chosen to go in is actually to really start working, you know, more with the public. So he's just published a new book, Economics for the Common Good, and it's, you know, that's the result of this kind of new awareness that he's had about explaining his work to the public, and it's his first book for a general audience rather than an academic audience. So it's certainly an interesting approach that he's taken.
Indeed. An interesting interview, page 14 for that one, and of course on the website too. That's all for this week's THE Issue Review podcast. If you want to comment on everything we've discussed in this edition, you can do. You'll find us on Twitter at Times Higher Ed. You'll find us on Facebook. And of course, you'll find us at timeshighereducation.com. That's all for this week's THE Issue Review podcast.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.